uses audio stage. In the performing arts, our work is mortal. This is something we're acutely aware of within our practice, something that we incorporate into the very definition of our art form, live performance.
But how do you record performance? After all, it is defined by a moment of presence. Peggy Phelan said it most definitively. The only life of performance is in the present. Performance cannot be saved, recorded, documented. Performance becomes itself through disappearance.
The danger lies in losing all record of what came before us, leaving artists to operate, in the words of Julian Merrick, as if theatre was a terra nullius, to be populated exclusively by the latest trends and stage styles, without any awareness that we've been here before or that our art is part of an ongoing cultural heritage. We are floating in uncharted waters. Today, we're going to talk about some of that heritage, its preservation and how it influences our work. I'm Fleur Kilpatrick.
I'm Jana Perkovic.
And welcome to Audio Stage. And today we're talking about performing arts histories. And I must say, I'm very happy because when Jana first suggested that we do this podcast and said that she enjoyed how I interviewed on my blog, I said, you do realise that most of that interview style comes from alcohol. And this is our first radio interview that has involved some alcohol. When I arrived and saw our beautiful guest, Angela, drinking Sauv Blanc at the bar, and she insisted on buying alcohol for us as well, saying that that was how the French do talking.
Yeah, this is, of course,
suddenly felt totally at ease.
This, of course, no excuse.
Because Angela is not Australian. Angela Conquet, our guest today, is the artistic director of Dance House, straight from France. Dance House is Melbourne's home for independent dance. Angela, how long have you been in Australia now, and what made that happen?
2 years and a half, and being fed up with Paris.
How is that even possible?
Well, you know, too many things happening at the same time and not being able to be part of them, probably that. Hysterical people, dirty streets, no longer seeing the beauty of Paris, probably.
But may I ask, how did you decide to get involved in contemporary dance in Australia? What did you know about Australian contemporary dance when you decided to become part of the Dance House team?
Well, surprisingly enough, I think I knew a little bit and probably enough to get me curious and intrigued. I happened to work in this amazing independent art centre in Paris called Mandovre, which is one of the major major independent art centres which exist in a repurposed art space. And it's mainly about not only a residency place, multidisciplinary residency centre, but it's also one of those venues thinking how to engage with the community and how to replace art in the very heart of the community. And surprisingly enough, all the Australian artists that were passing through Paris and needing space ended up at Mandovre. And I think what got me really intrigued, and probably I shouldn't be saying this now that I'm in Australia, I was intrigued by this feeling of what you define here is the cultural cringe, and what they called being not only geographically isolated but intellectually isolated, like how one thing impacted on the other. And for me, I was absolutely sure that it was not possible. I mean, in the age of speed and all this wonderful gadgets that, you know, connect us to people and ideas and, you know, at the other end of the world.
Low-cost airlines, internet.
Exactly. How can you feel that we are... Yes, indeed, Australia is so far away, but how can you feel intellectually disconnected from whatever is happening in the wider world? And I kind of started a sorts of conversations with this artist, and then I grew increasingly curious about what was happening in Australia, and I realized that probably the artists that we were seeing quite often in Paris and in Europe were not probably the most interesting ones, or not the ones that appealed to me, and that something else was happening here. And you know, I was thinking, well, you know, you work in the art of movement. Why not move a little bit? And
yeah.
I came to the other end of the world.
Can I ask, like, now that you've been here for a while, how do you feel about that term? Is that something that you feel does apply to this country?
Look, coming from Paris, yes, you know, I mean, I'm going to talk just about Paris for a little bit. It's, you know, when you live in Paris, and I'm going to talk about contemporary dance, you're in a, you know, in a capital city, you have about what? In between September and June, you have about 150 shows an evening that you can see in dance, just contemporary dance.
That's
I'm not
disgusting.
Talking about ballet. Yes, not only ballet, but also very frustrating. And then you have all sorts of thinkers and people, and, you know, funnily enough, probably I only know 3 people with a PhD in dance in France, whereas here I know about 50. So that's another one of those contradictions. Just mentioning that in passing. But and of course you're in France, but funnily enough, we no longer talk about where you come from. So you don't say as an artist, you know, I'm a French artist or I come from Paris. You say I come from Europe. And yes, of course, ideas and bodies and minds circulate a lot more easily in Europe because, you know, you just jump on a train and you're in Belgium or in Switzerland. And yes, you can be more aware of, you know, trends and waves and patterns in the arts happening, you know, in a certain, you know, you can speak about Eastern European research or, you know. So, yes, definitely you feel very connected, very inspired, very influenced even. You then go to, you know, to the US, what, it's a 7-hour flight? Mm. Yes, you're in the middle of yet another world, but it's just 7 hours away. So when I moved here, I think I understood a little bit better what distance does. I think it can be frightening. And yes, in a certain way, when I moved here, I had a moment of panic because I was thinking, oh, my God, how am I going to keep up with all this amazing thinking and doing? And one big problem for me was how am I going to see works now that I can no longer travel every 3 days and go to the other end of Europe. And I understood a little bit that kind of panic, and I see it as a panic and not as a, you know, kind of entrenched phenomenon. But at the same time, what I admire here quite a lot is that because of that distance, and probably also because I grew up in Eastern Europe at a time where Eastern Europe was not what it is today, and that eagerness to learn, to find that feeling of being connected and knowing what's happening in the outer world was so much there that I think today, I really think that if you really want to know all about those things, yes, you find a way to do it. And it's easy.
Yeah.
If you just grab a book, grab internet. It becomes tricky when it comes to seeing, you know, being up to date or, you know, analyzing trends in performance art, and probably this is what we will be talking about. But in terms of thinking, art thinking, I think it's, yes, definitely, it's amazing if you can travel. And many people here have the, you know, this amazing travel grants and everything. And they do get to travel, and great. But at the same time, it's possible to travel with your mind as well.
Yeah.
There are limits to that, but it's possible.
So, having realized that Australia is geographically quite isolated from the rest of the world, do you think that the Australian dance history is a separate story from the history of, say, Western dance? Or do you think that it is a part of the bigger narrative?
That's a very good question. So what I will be saying here is very, very personal, so very biased, of course.
All histories are.
All histories are, indeed. Thank you for reassuring me. Look, I think Australian dance has been deeply influenced by American dance, American postmodernists. I think because so many amazing artists got to travel, probably there was not much happening at a certain time, probably in the 60s, 70s here, and they all managed to go somehow to New York, and this is where, you know, the time when, you know, Judson Church and, oh my God, Trisha Brown and, you know, Yvonne Rainer and all these amazing people, and they did get to work with them, and then they came back with that knowledge. And I think this is what is really, really what fascinates me about the actual ecology of contemporary dance here in Australia is that you have people going away and coming back. And as much as I do not believe in national identities, and, you know, I do think we carry so many things in us, but I wouldn't define that as a national identity. And, of course, we're all shaped up by, you know, the countries we live in, but not more than we are shaped by people, and people can, or books, and that can come from any other sources and places. But what really fascinates me about Australian dance is, and probably that was kind of pinned down by a recent conversation I have with Rosalie Goldberg from Performa in New York. She was asking me, if you were to present an Australian artist at Performa in New York, what artists would you present? And I kept saying, you know, it's all about the context, and, you know, how relevant can we be about the context? And she said, okay, tell me what artist? And I mentioned an artist and said, tell me why. And I said, well, because he's unique. But why? And I said, well, he has a certain Australianness about it, and that's what your sophisticated New York audiences have not seen yet. And then we got in this whole conversation about, okay, what makes an artist Australian, but at the same time completely open to the world? Because, you know, if you're Australian, you know, like if it's something that's completely, you know,
like
Australian,
a cultural in-joke. Or, yeah.
Exactly. Then what's the interest? And yeah. And I think what I really find fascinating, and I'm not going to talk so much about this history of contemporary dance here in Australia, but I think what really fascinates me is when you have people who are born here, who are trained here, and then they go away and they get all these amazing experiences in, you know, in the US and in Europe. And then they come back. And this is where it becomes fascinating, because this is where you really see that in a way they have an approach. I think it's the approach to space that really makes them Australian. We have this joke in Europe saying, oh, you know, Australian dancers are so much space eaters, because, you know, it's a lot of movement and, you know, it's always about the movement and the beauty of the movement and, you know, coming from a country where we've kind of invented the non-movement and non-dance, sometimes you're like, oh, it's too much. But with certain artists, I think it's fascinating because you can tell from a mile off they have an approach to space which is completely different to what you see in Europe. We have a different approach to time and space, which in French we call espace-temps, which becomes a kind of unified concept. And here I wouldn't say the approach to time is different, but the approach to space. And you can see it from the way people walk down on the streets. And it took me like a month when I moved to Australia. Something was, you know, I kind of observe people walking down the streets, and I was thinking, what is different? It's not because the streets are larger, and it's not because, you know, it's the rhythm and the pace is different. People are not running to their work. That's great, but it was not that. And then I realized it's the space, and people move differently. Like the way you walk, this is where you realize that your body says so many things about you. And I can tell an Australian, give me one Australian in the streets of Paris,
really?
And I can tell him from a mile off.
That's amazing. I've had conversations with an actor about accents and talking about that he thinks the accents are influenced by the landscape, and that's how you get these different sort of these amazing elongated sounds of the Australian accent. And Jana's nodding vigorously
at
me
there. I have to say, when I moved here, I was told that the Australian accent is hugely influenced by having to protect your mouth from flies flying in. And so it's quite small. It's not very expressive, you know, because you don't know. But I agree with that. When I moved to Australia, I found people on the street intolerable. I found that they took up so much space and they didn't really know how to walk kind of elegantly and smallly, which is what, you know, what you learn
coming
to
from
do.
Europe, you have
you know,
to,
visiting,
you must.
Exactly. You learn how to be small and sort of aerodynamic so that you can squeeze through the crowd. And now when I go to Europe, I just feel that I'm so much freer than everyone else. You know, I can own the space, and everyone else is really quite small and sort of humble. And it's not nice.
Was the in-house Australian here? I apologize on behalf of us all for our extravagant
Australian
space.
Well, no, but I think it's something that's really visible in Australian dance, not so much in the Australian theatre, because I think the Australian theatre is very influenced by the British theatre, which is very still.
Mm.
You know, the Australian actors don't move very much on stage, but Australian dancers do, and they really do define larger spaces with their movement.
Mm. Or quite the opposite. They make the choice not to make much movement, but there is that awareness of the space that, and they build that awareness for us, the viewers, the audience, and then that deliberate choice of not using the space, but of us being aware of an immensity of the space that they deliberately do not use, that, again, is very Australian. And I think it's a shame I couldn't give that answer to Rosalie, because, oh my God, maybe she could have presented that artist. But it's a shame now that I, the more I think about it, yes, totally, that's what makes probably Australian dance so interesting. Because then with dance, you know, you can get a very rigorous technical training, but if you look at the way the bodies are trained here, yes, indeed, probably more of an American tradition of, you know, approaching movement. But I guess in terms of conceiving a choreographical approach of the space, as much as you try to conceptualize, I think if there is any at all, this is where your national identity comes in, because because it's inbuilt in the moving body. And as much as we, you know, we do talk, you know, in France we have, we do talk in, actually not only in France, but we do talk about what we call, you know, body social. And yes, you know, the body is and says so much about you and the context you live in, and it impacts in the on the way you move and you conceive your work, and whichever way you look at the moving body here, it does say a lot about Australia indirectly.
So just to return a little bit to the question that we opened with, which is the question of history, there is this sort of cliche here that Australian performing arts don't know their history and they're not careful to write their history. Do you think that this is true? And if it's true, is it something specific to Australia? Is it different in Europe?
I think it's absolutely true. I wonder if to what extent it's... Sometimes, you know, I try to understand specifically Australian things and then I'm being told, oh, don't forget this country never had a revolution. So I think... I don't know exactly to what that is due, but I think probably in Europe there was a different urgency in writing the history of dance, and also because, you know, this is where it was born, you know, classical ballet, and then we moved on to something else. And probably from the 1800s, you know, Fourier wrote down the first concepts of dance choreographed movement, and then the others arrived and, you know, they kind of gave the first analytical tools to the moving body because there was a need to theorize or conceptualize. And I think here, yes, indeed, we completely lack that. And not only do we lack that, but there is also a lack of acknowledgement. So I wonder to what extent one impacts on the other. And I am surprised that when Australian dance is taught, I'm surprised not to see the big names of what I think Australian dance is. I arrived here knowing about Russell Dumas, and then I realized that many of my dance peers didn't know about Russell Dumas, and he's such an iconic figure, and he trained so many generations of performers, and, you know, maybe the most important dance makers today, like Lucy Guerin and Rebecca Hilton, they all come out of Russell's company, and it is a shame that, you know, somebody like him is not fully acknowledged in you know, in schools in a way, or, you know, and... in French, we say it stops you from reinventing hot water every time. because I think if you have a history and you study that history, well, then you know that, oh, you're not the first one doing that. And then it saves time and you think maybe you're less amazing than you think you are. Mm-hmm. And I do see that quite often with the emerging artists here. Sometimes they think they've invented the... you know, the No Manifesto, well, look back at Yvonne Rainer, you know, it was done before, you know, things like that. And I think making art is about a sedimentation of layers, and whatever we do today indirectly reflects what was done before. Maybe it's a, you know, it comes as an opposition to what was done before, or as a continuation, or as an echo, but we need to be aware of that. And I do think in Australia we're not aware of what's been done.
Yeah, I think it's amazing to think of Australia in particular as being so oblivious to its history, because when we're talking about a history of sort of theatre and performance and dance since European settlement, we're talking such a tiny time frame, and it seems as if with so little effort we could reach back into the past and grab those details. So many of the most innovative Australian artists of the 20th century are still alive to talk to about this stuff. It seems like it would be so
completely
easy.
And you have walking archives. I mean, there are so many people who have all that knowledge. And I think it comes down to the question of urgency, you know. I think everyone,
absolutely.
You know, when you have a Merce Cunningham who died, and we knew that, you know, his work would not be tourable after, because that's how he conceived his legacy. It was kind of fine because we knew this is how it was supposed to happen. When Pina Bausch died and we thought, oh, you know, the company will continue, you know, Dominique Mercier will be director. And actually, yes, the company tours, but it's not the same thing. And this is where we realize that not only do we work with the most ephemeral of art forms when it comes to dance, but we work with people. And if we do not take the chance to preserve something when it can be preserved, some things are lost forever. And then, yes, we can look at how things are remembered or misremembered, as you said in your introduction. But aren't we losing something there?
Yeah, it makes me think that if perhaps that ignorance is because of, rather than in spite of, our newness, that it's this sense of that our youth means that we haven't really experienced that permanent losing of...
I think it's a sense of loss. Yeah. And I think because Australia is such a young nation, and I think it comes down completely to the relationship you have with history and how far back history goes.
Yeah.
And again, with history comes the sense of urgency and what's really urgent today to do and to say and to... And yeah, maybe for that, Australians are a little bit laid back, and I'm concerned sometimes that I see amazing work and it's not documented. And you wonder, especially with dance, I wonder, okay, so in 20 years when we will acknowledge that, you know, somebody like Russell Dumont was fundamental in development of contemporary dance in Australia, how much do we have on tape?
Yeah.
Even if it's bad quality, how much do we have on tape?
So you have come to Australia to take artistic direction of Dance House, which is an old, for Australian terms, it's an old institution. It's an important institution of contemporary dance. And what I found very interesting with your directorship was that you seemed straight away, right from the start, very, very interested in legacy and in remembering and in memory. You started a magazine. You started Dance House Diaries. I read it as an attempt to remember this time. And you have also, we should talk about this later, you have also initiated an award. And in the first editorial of the Dance House Diary, you talk about the need to remember dance. So how do you see your project at the Dance House?
I must say that when I arrived at Dance House, we celebrated our 20th anniversary, and I've inherited of all that legacy because I had to organise an anniversary season, and part of this project was not the diary, then the publication came later, but it was this project which was called, and it still is called, Digital Quilt, which was a sort of a live, ongoing archiving system which was there to build some of that legacy and to keep some solid track of what happened at Dance House, because we realized how much Dance House has been quietly influential all these past 20 years, because you take any name of whoever is a big name now in Australian dance and they have all come in their resumes, you have the name of Dance House sooner or later. Yeah. So all of a sudden I became aware that nothing much was there. I mean, you know, scattered programs and things. And actually we used this online archive a bit like, William Forsythe website, where they actually keep the patterns of choreography. Well, what we did, we interviewed about 50 people who made the history of Dance House, and we asked them to not only say an anecdote or share a memory about Dance House, and it was amazing, but also to offer a gesture and a movement to Dance House as an anniversary gift. And I think that was my idea, and I can tell you why we did that. It was very directly inspired by a quote that one of the most famous writers, but also dance journalists in France, Hervé Guibert, he said, you know, these choreographers are these strange creatures whom, with their art, they buy back the death of our gestures, our movements. And that stayed with me because I think, in a way, it's so true. And I really panicked when I arrived and said, okay, so where are the 20 years of Dance House? And this is how we now have this ongoing online archive, which is continuously fed with projects we do. So you can see things that we did yesterday, just as you can see archives and written tracks and programs of things that were done, maybe not 20 years ago, because unfortunately it was not properly documented, but still things that were done a long time ago. And I think, you know, when you work with dance, it's the most ephemeral of art forms. So, you know, you keep telling yourself that whichever way you look at it, it's so much in the instant and it's so much about the present. And a work itself, you know, you have it today and then the same work is presented 5 years later. It has become slightly something different because the body accumulates layers and layers of things that you are even not aware of as a choreographer. I think the moment a choreographer puts out a work, it no longer belongs to him. It belongs to the body of the dancer. It belongs to the gaze of the viewer. And all that is shifting and shifts all the time. And yes, that's what prompted that. With the diary, it was more of an attempt to give a written space to a non-text-based art form. And it's another way of preserving a work by linking the way movement is thought with the written word. And there's a lot there. We tend to forget that dance is such a philosophical art form as well.
So I wanted to ask, in our introduction, we quote Peggy Phelan, who very famously said, the point of performance is in its disappearance. Live performance happens and then it's gone, and that's exactly what makes it what it is. But she writes from the perspective of visual art, the performance art as it exists within visual arts, and to a certain extent there's an element of choice there. You know, visual art sort of goes, wow, ephemeral act, how amazing, we are resisting capitalism, we are resisting reproduction, we are resisting...
But then you have the catalogue of the exhibition.
Yes. There's always you're always asked about documentation and so on. Performing arts do not have that choice and have never had that choice. The performing person, act, always disappears, and dance in particular is extraordinarily ephemeral. I remember talking to Jordan Beth Vincent, who once said, you do realize that dance criticism is largely the only thing that remains, and so much more important than, say, theater criticism, because you will always have the play left.
Presuming it's published.
Well, in Australia, yes, one never knows. But in dance, dance criticism assumes this extraordinary role of sometimes being the only memory of the work. And I do remember reading one of the reviews, you know, historical in the 1980s, of Rosas Danse Rosas, a beautiful, famous, you know, classical choreography by now by Anteresa de Kersmaker and Rosas, where the New York reviewer, this is a piece that I think had one of its early performances in New York, if not the premiere, and she talks about seeing female labor in the work, which is something I'd never seen in it. And suddenly I realized, wow, this is why this work is important, because this is how it was perceived at the time. This is how people of the time saw the work. This is why it entered history. So what are the strategies that you and contemporary dance has for remembering dance?
Well, exactly with what you've just said, this is where you realize the tremendous importance of critics and of the written word, because that's one thing that stays. Before I answer that question, actually, I'd just like to quote... maybe just as a reflection to what you were saying, because it's very poetic and we keep forgetting about that. But this wonderful quote by Merce Cunningham, who was saying, you have to love dancing to stick to it. It gives you nothing back, no manuscript to store away, no paintings to show on walls and maybe hang in museums, no poems to be printed and sold, nothing but that fleeting single moment when you feel alive. So our stock and trade is that, with dance.
Absolutely.
So this is something that I really think that in the job I have, in the work I do every day, I have that urgency, that nothing can replace that moment. Once you've understand that, and once you make every effort possible to get the right people in the theatre and to see the work when it's happening, what do you do next? And we know so often that sometimes we cannot get all the people we want in the house to see the work. And indeed, then it comes down to strategies, as you say. So what do we do? And probably to go back to your example with Anne-Theresa de Kersmaker, and also not only to illustrate how I think she just happened to find this amazing strategy, which it's very smart, and actually to me it has almost become another art form in itself, another genre. Kersmaker was lucky enough to be surrounded by people who were filmmakers from the early days when she graduated school, and she worked with Thierry Demet, who's one of the most amazing filmmakers in Belgium. And when she made Rosas, but the very first work that she made when she graduated dance and she was in New York was Fars, to the Five Studies, to the music of Steve Reich.
This is one of my favorite dance works ever,
and
I just have to say.
And I think, you know, I quote that example quite often because she did this work 30, 35 years ago. I always saw that work as a film, the Thierry Demet film that he did with Anne-Theresa de Kersmaker and Michel Andemet, who's the performer. It's a duet. And also last year, I finally saw this work live, and I finally understood that there are dance works that they have a certain timelessness. They're not even out of time. They're not even relevant to a context as much as they were relevant to a context 35 years ago. It's a sort of timelessness, and I wonder to what extent dance probably is the only art form that can have that. But I always carried with me this film that Terry made of this work, which is the same choreographic material filmed in some abandoned industrial site. And this work is filmed with scarce light, but yet very sophisticated, because you have a sort of the shadows of these two performers, and then you see five shadows, and then because it's such a geometrical pattern, those shadows dance as much as the bodies, and and it becomes a different art form for me and a different work of art when you look at that film. And I wonder to what extent maybe that's the smartest way to preserve dance, because in a way, we were talking about that earlier, but in a way it's as if you have Aunt Teresa showing you through the lenses of the camera the detail that you must look at now that you probably wouldn't not even perceive with the naked eye if you were to watch the performance. But when I saw the live performance, my gaze was directed by what I had seen, directed or manipulated or... manipulated maybe in a way, because I had seen this film so many times, and then I see finally the work live, and actually I was waiting for the nuance, for the thing, for the, and then when you see the same work performed in MoMA, just Kersmacher dancing the same thing on sand, people watching the performance, you know how MoMA you can watch from above, and then you see this work and it's just her, it's no longer a duet, and at the end what's left, it's a completely geometrical pattern on the sand. And you see, actually, it's another reinterpretation of the same choreographic material and yet another way of keeping something. And I think, you know, this is where Kersmacher is quite smart. She knew exactly that her works probably may survive time, but if there's one way they can survive time, it's on the lenses of a camera, through the lenses of a camera. And she got the right people on board. And it's almost, you know, it's another art form in a way.
This is really true. Dance really works with film very well, or has in the past 30 years. And theatre doesn't really. It's interesting how theatre has not managed really to learn how to use film to capture the experience or the effect of the staging. We rely so much on script in theatre and dance, because in dance there is no script, really. There is, you cannot separate the template from the performance itself. That seems to have been so much more interest in using film to capture the flavour, perhaps, of the live.
Maybe it comes down to the urgency. I was the other day at the Cine Biennale with the Tacita Din show, filmed, you know, with this amazing actor, and was filmed with three cameras. And I think the actual work will become, when she will make a film out of the live performance that we saw and we were all part of that. But I think the work is elsewhere. But if you look at this amazing former choreographer, now filmmaker, Australian, Tracy Mitchell, she has made works for the stage, and then she filmed that, the same choreographies for the camera. And even though I was not lucky enough to see the actual choreographies, then the actual films are just a masterpiece. And it's amazing, because, yes, you can guide the eye into the density of a gesture, probably something that we would have not been able to see as such live. And it's fascinating. It's maybe that's one amazing way of preserving dance. How many are lucky to have that kind of eye or skills when they make a new work? And in that sense, documentation of dance is probably quite impossible if you do not have a good video person.
I spent the day searching back through my my notes from my undergrad trying to find this one quote that I couldn't remember who said it or the exact wording, but I guess it speaks volumes of this line that it's stuck, that the essence of it has stuck in my head for, you know, 6 years. But it was basically, it was a choreographer in the 80s talking about how exhausting it was in contemporary dance to have to retread the same ground again and again, and having to break conventions that she thought had been broken a decade ago, that she remembered breaking herself a decade ago. And she was talking about more her audience than her fellow choreographers, and sort of a frustration that they weren't keeping up with her and seemed to have a very short collective memory. And while I absolutely appreciate this quote and feel for this choreographer, it also did make me think about, I have a lot of respect for the intelligence of these people that are sitting in the dark theatres with us, and also I value a lot, I think that it's part of the mystery and the appeal of live theatre is, of course, that people are allowed to experience things as a first, and that you sort of can't take that away from them. And, you know, once again, to go back to Peggy Phelan, she's saying that performance honours the idea that a limited number of people in a specific time, space frame can have an experience of value which leaves no visible trace afterwards. Performance is non-reproductive. It is this quality which makes performance the runt of the litter of the contemporary art. And yet, performance implicates the real through the presence of live bodies. And I would add that it also emulates mortality when the curtain falls. It's what Phelan would call a manically charged present, which is just such a great term. But I think it's the right of an audience to come in and experience something for the first time and to arrive in the venue without sort of prior knowledge and without having to research up in a way. They're totally allowed to arrive as ignorant as they want, which is a beautiful thing. But as artists, how do we balance this wanting to move forward with our art form whilst taking our audiences on a journey of perpetual firsts? And, yeah.
It is a tricky journey because with dance, yes, we keep saying, it's the most universal of art forms, and it is, and sometimes it's amazing the many interpretations that you get from an artwork. And God knows that, we, in France, for instance, we have so much critical analysis and critical discourse of a dance piece, and sometimes I read that and I think, oh, actually, I didn't quite get it like this. And then you listen to what the novice would think, and then you have an equally interesting theory. And I think in that lies the interest of this art form, that it gives multiple interpretations. And I think it's not so much about, I think people with dance fear that they will not understand that, oh my God, if you haven't read all Deleuze, you will not get anything or something. And I think what's important to remember is that it's about allowing yourself the curiosity to embark on a journey, or to allow yourself to be embarked on a journey by the artist. And I think when I think that we've managed, because we are the shadow people, we connect, the artwork with the audience.
Yeah.
And when I think that I've managed my, I've kind of succeeded in what I do, is when I feel that people are, almost get a physical reaction, and I can tell when people are into the work because I see the physical reaction of their own bodies and how they engage with the work. It's amazing. I've presented recently with this amazing young choreographer, Australian, Matthew Day. He does this repetitive durational work and very highly physical. At the end of the show, you see half of the audience that you can feel that their body is aching.
Yeah.
And I think this is where it really worked. And maybe it's not always about, of course, it's never, almost never about always a pleasing experience or an entertaining experience. I think you have to, if when you say, what do you expect when you come into a theatre to see something, I think it's about accepting that we are not here to be entertained. If you want to be entertained, you go to other things. Art is about something else. So you have to allow yourself the space, not necessarily to be entertained, but to allow for something to happen within you, to be stirred, to be
provoked,
and provoked. And even if it's disagreeable, I think this is where, as much as you think about it, this is where it makes sense. And maybe art is about that. And in a way, I think, with dance, we all accept our own mortality, or the actual embedded mortality of the art form, because it's very much about the instant, about the actual bodies right there, right now. And that's why we can't be wrong. We can't allow ourselves not to present the important artists or not to get the audiences there. So it's, if you see things like that, it's a huge pressure on us, the art workers behind that. But I think, the success or the longevity of an artwork, especially in dance, starts and ends with the first time and the last time you thought about the work. And that can happen years after. And very often I presented highly experimental, unbearably challenging shows. And then people would come and say, oh, this is contemporary dance. And you'd say, well, this can be contemporary dance. And then the same people, 5, 6, 10 years after, they would come to you and say, oh, you remember that show? I can't remember the name of the artist, and I can't remember when it was. But, I remember that tiny thing. It did this to me. And I think, yes, 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 this is... And probably
you're going to carry that for decades.
And probably, exactly. And I think probably this is where magic operates. If you have, I keep saying that I will always remember one of the very first images that I had myself. I don't think I was kind of thinking of working in contemporary dance. And somehow, I don't even know how and when I saw 3 minutes, let's say, of Kaffee Müller by Pina Bausch. And It just blew me away. And then, when you get to see the actual piece, and you get to meet Pina Bausch, and I was lucky enough and fortunate enough, to actually meet Pina Bausch and talk to Pina Bausch. Yes, oh my God. And I wonder sometimes, to what extent I'm not doing this job because I want to provoke that in as many people as I can. Not necessarily, of course, Pina Bausch is Pina Bausch, but even to a lesser extent. And I think if a work stays, let's say you have a theatre full of people, but if a work stays with people, with some people, like, let's say out of a, 500 audience. It stays with a few people years after. I think we've managed something there. It's a gambling thing, but I think this is where it makes sense. I think, yes, the performance dies away with the second it finishes, but where it lives, it's where it's with you. So
I think this is really an interesting point, because criticism, what remains as history of performing arts, often is exactly that. It records the effect of a work on an audience member, and in a certain sense on that room, because a critic is always to some extent influenced by the room. I remember reading an interview with the artistic director of, I think, MES Festival, which is in Sarajevo, I think. This was maybe 2011 or 2012, and he was talking about programming a dance, which was two naked dancers. And he said, you know, people say, well, we've seen this in the 70s. No, we haven't. Not in this town. We did not see this in the 70s. Just because someone saw it in Paris in the 70s does not mean that it actually happened here. Perhaps because of cultural cringe, which exists in places other than Australia, there is this idea that all art history runs parallel in every country at the same time, and that is just not true.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And this is where you see that perhaps dance is probably the most ephemeral of art forms, but probably the one with the most long-lasting impact. And this is where you see that the sedimentation of layers of meaning in the moving body is that a work that was presented in the 60s, probably so much of, of an activist kind of piece, you show it 40 years later in Paris, and I'm specifically talking about Tricia Brown's early works, and it makes as much sense then as it made in the 60s. And I think it is important to bring those works to where they couldn't be seen, because you need to see the actual body, the actual body movement, and as much as you can watch now videos and other ways of preserving the artwork, definitely, definitely nothing can replace that live experience, because I think it's the artwork, it's in the eye of the beholder. So it's what you make of it when you see it, actually, and nothing can replace that unless it is highly and sophisticatedly orchestrated by a Thierry Domer filming dance works. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I would always advocate for, you know, as much as a work is famous and could have toured, oh my God, you know, like Fars is still touring today. And I know why it's touring, because it's about the timelessness of the work, and it's so relevant today that it was, you know, 30 years ago.
And also I think there's the right time for a certain environment to see a certain work. You know, through festivals, we see a lot of work that has aged to some extent, that is no longer new. But in a relatively isolated context, such as Australia, you see certain works really make an impact, because for years after a certain work has been shown, it resonates in the local art. I mean, one of the works is, I'd say, Jerome Bell's Pichet, Clunton and I, and Show Must Go On. Show Must Go On was about 10 years old when it was shown here. And still, people left the theatre going, wow! And it really, really, really left a mark on the arts here. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, Einstein on the Beach was very old by the time it got to us last year, but I feel like I've seen echoes of that in the last 6 months in theatre around Australia. But, you know, people get excited because, you know, you can read about all these things all you like, as we say, but there's nothing like sitting in the theatre for the first time and watching Einstein on the Beach and feeling that impact and feeling that sense of your metabolism slowing to the pace of that performance in a way that you could never experience by watching clips on YouTube.
And I think it's so much stronger. It's so much stronger for nonverbal work, because verbal work, where there is a text, you can sort of read it and sort of learn about it. And when you learn about it, you haven't really experienced the work, but you have sort of learned what you're supposed to think about it, which is impossible to convey in a work that's based on movement and sound and so on. And so I think they last longer. They can be experienced afresh for longer, because the audience is not corrupted with these premeditated readings.
But this is where you also realize that with dance comes another problem, and that's something that I hear quite often in dance. It's what's left of a piece of work. It's the legacy that comes with the dancer. And I think with some pieces of work, they're so dependent on the eye of the choreographer when he or she is still there, that once he or she is no longer there, whichever way you look at it, the work is no longer the same. Mm. And I'm specifically referring to Amos Cunningham. I completely agree with his legacy plan, which is actually no legacy. I mean, it's all on tape and whatever, but the company is no longer touring his works. And I must say, last year I was in New York and I happened to see a Martha Graham piece, funnily enough, in the Merce Cunningham studio. So the joke was running around, it's the mother who ate a son. But I saw this very early soul of Martha Graham Lamentations, which was made right after the war, and you know, that kind of expressionistic loaded solo, feel like committing suicide when you watch it. And it was great to look at that, and it was performed by one of the iconic dancers of the company, and still it did nothing to me. And it was the first time I saw that solo performed live. And you watch Martha Graham on a very, very poor quality video, and it's different. And it makes me think now of Pina Bausch, who's no longer there. Her company is still there, still touring the works. I think it's a terrible mistake, because if there's one thing that glued that company together and that made this company amazing and quite singular was Pina Bausch's eye and how she perceived the body and how she... She said very little, but, you know, she was such a... There was so much precision in the guidelines that she gave, to the instructions that she gave to the dancers, that as much as you have people who have worked with her for the past 30 years, that precision is no longer there, and you can see it in the actual work. So the last two or three pieces that still tour do not have the quality that I think Pina would like. And I am lucky enough to have lived in Paris, and I've seen everything that she presented in the past 12 years, all the works, just like the newer works, the fancier, kind of more entertaining ones. And I realized that actually maybe it's better if we watch a Pina film by Wim Wenders, which is a wonderful homage to Pina, than just go and see a Pina Bausch work now touring. And this is where you understand the mortality of the art form, because very often it comes and goes with a choreographer. And as much as you can preserve the scores, we have so many ways now of notating that, and you know, we know exactly how to put on paper the most intricate choreographies. Maybe it's the liveliest of art forms. Maybe something starts and ends with that person. And again, yeah, I'm thinking again, oh my God, there's urgency, you know, to see, do, feel as much as possible when these people are around.
Now, to return to present time, you have made quite an effort to present Australian artists in Europe. Can you talk about which ones, how you chose them, why you would do that?
I think presenting Australian artists in Europe came out of a challenge, because when I moved here, and God knows in Paris you have about 300 artists living in Paris and in dance only, and everyone was saying, oh, you know, there's nothing happening in Australia. I found that outrageous. And I arrived here, and I think, you know, luckily I come from the independent sector, and I know the vibrancy of any independent sector. I know this is where it's happening. And Australia just confirmed that. And yes, in the independent sector in Australia, you have some of the most important and interesting artists. And these are precisely the ones that I wanted to support and to tour internationally. Also, probably going back to the earlier conversation about what makes these artists unique, and I would say it's exactly the Australian flavour to their work. And surprisingly enough, the artists that we're supporting internationally are probably the most minimalist artists you get in contemporary dance in Australia. And I'm specifically talking about Matthew Day and Sandra Parker and Natalie Albert, soon to go to Avignon. These are people who work with very durational works, very, very challenging scores, very physical and yet minimal. And I think it's important to show that Australia is not all about athletic movement, as you can see very often, but it's not only about that. And there's a lot of thought that goes, and a lot of rigor that goes in the way these young people think their works. And it was an amazing success, because when we presented Matthew Day and Sandra Parker in Paris last year, well, not dancers, but this artist and the independent dance sector in Australia had a one-page article in Le Monde. And all of a sudden we were rediscovering Australian dance, because it's not only about the Australian ballet, and it's about something else. And I was happy that I managed to bring this talent to Paris, where we kind of seen it all, done it all. And the audiences are extremely sophisticated, and still they were interested in this artist, and they've acknowledged that quality. And I think it brings confidence, not only acknowledgement to the artist, but it brings confidence to the artist and maybe wipes away a little bit of that cultural cringe. No, these people make work which is as solid as any other European work, and it's worthwhile touring them, and it's good.
And now you're taking them to Avignon?
I'm taking them to Avignon. Well, not me, our French partners. Thank you, French partners. Yes.
I wanted to ask, would you say that you are writing the Australian dance history with gestures such as these? And I'm asking this is a personal question, because I saw Maximum by Natalie Abbott a couple of nights ago, and just before the show started, Chris Boyd, dance critic, Australian, he whispered into my ear, "Do you know that Angela Kunke is taking this work to Avignon?" And immediately I was watching this work and I was not thinking, okay, this is an emerging artist making some sort of whatever work at Next Wave. This could be good, this could be crap. I was thinking, this must be very important. Angela has selected this work. This must be saying something about Australian dance right now. And this is really true. I was immediately watching it as a representative of our time and space.
Well, really, in all modesty, I wouldn't say I'm writing any history at all. And actually, nobody, I think you don't become aware of history unless, you know, years after, you know. And the credit shouldn't go to me, really. It should go to this French presenter, Christophe Martin, who actually had a simple conversation with Natalie about at Dance Massive last year, and she was telling him about this project. And I was there, and it did sound interesting, but it could have gone anywhere. And he really trusted her. And I then saw several developments, and then I understood that I really feared, maybe I didn't trust her so much, I shouldn't be saying that, but I was afraid that she would take this, you know, collaboration between a dancer and a bodybuilder. I mean, oh my God, there are so many hidden traps there. It could have gone anywhere, and I was most afraid of the funny aspect. I was hoping, praying God, that she would not go into anything funny and anything pleasing, and thank God she didn't. And it's an amazing work, because I think it completely challenges you in your expectations. The actual show could only be the fact that you have these two very different bodies with very different physicalities, and in the tiniest movement they're worlds apart, and still they are in a unison from beginning till the end, and there is no actual relationship in between those two bodies, and yet they are so much together, and what would not exist without the other, and though they're mutual presence is not acknowledged by the other one. And I think this work is fascinating because it's pointing a mirror to the interest in the body in Australia and how much time it is spent here to cultivate the body, not always the mind with it. You know, I like to say, you know, mens sana in corpore sano, but it's about the body. Actually, this guy, Donnie, is an engineer. And it's amazing because there is this intelligence of the body which even escapes him. He's not even aware how, for a hardcore audience member like I was, and you certainly was, I think it was just fascinating to watch the very, again, geometrical choreography. It's all very simple. It's very, you kind of get it. You wonder where it's going to go. Each time you think you've got it, it goes elsewhere. It never goes where you want it to go. It gets to a point where you almost feel like asking her to stop because your body is hurting you, when she's climbing on this bodybuilder and he's holding her, and she strives to have this upright position about, you don't really know what it is, but it's like a sort of activist movement, something looking at the sky, God, something.
They're both demonstrating, I'd like you to know.
Yes. and it's just fascinating. And yes, I think Natalie Abbott, it's her second full-length work. I think she's very brave, very audacious, and probably it's going to be one of the strongest works to see in dance in Avignon, and I have no doubts about that. And I think people like this, you know, should be, yes, definitely supported.
That's wonderful. Can we ask, how do you think the work that's happening today is going to be remembered, you know, whenever we stop and turn and remember, be that 20 years, 50 years?
I think the way we remember a work is always influenced by the times that we live in, and I think it's, what is even more interesting is not only how we remember the work, but how we misremember. And I think this is where the actual work becomes something else, and I think the way we carry those memories actually can sometimes not be very true to reality, but they probably is what makes us really understand how we engaged with the work years before. I have no idea, probably because I'm more familiar with the history of French dance. I see works that were a scandal when they were made, when Jérôme Bell presented his first show, and then there was this critic, like a dance guru in criticism in dance in France, and she coined this term about, oh, there's no movement. This is like a non-dance thing for non-audiences. And it was, nobody knew then what it meant. And it coined a whole new wave, and it was a scandal. And everyone was saying, how can you remove movement from the art of movement? And again, it was a scandal. And now when we think about it, this is how we explain the whole conceptual wave of abstract works that we've had in the past almost 15 years in the history of contemporary dance in France. And I now think we don't even think how outrageous it was then. And we need, I think it was explained by a political moment, by a moment in time when movement was too much. Maybe like in theatre sometimes, you know, you just get rid of the text and then you have a whole piece with three lines. It's kind of the same thing. And I think it's always explained by a wider context. And the way we filter things are very, very much influenced by a social, political, economical context. And this is where you see that precisely, in particular, this art form is never dissociated from that, because we work with an amazing tool, which is as much about the present times as it is as any other, probably more than any other art form, which is our bodies and the way you work with your body. It does mirror something that's societal, that's something that translates something that's happening right now today in the world. And then the way we remember that, then it's probably, you know, filtered through many things which are probably very subjective or very biased or very orchestrated, very much orchestrated by critics, if you've got a strong critic's voice, very much orchestrated by that. But I still think that the random guy, like the normal audience, is not that much influenced by critics. So I guess I have no idea. I do think that we'll remember something at all. And I think if we do, then in whichever way, then if we remember, again, I think it starts and ends with the last time we thought of a work. And I do think that many people will think of the works. And, you know, when you have it can be something intellectual, or it can be something that's completely more of a feeling, or of a, you know, something that appeals both to your mind or to your senses. But if it stays with you in whichever way, in an intellectual way or in a very poetic way, then both the artist and us and arts workers, probably we've managed our fight with the mortality.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Well, that's it for today. So our guest today has been Angela, and thank you so much for your time.
We'll be continuing
to explore this question of how Australian performance remembers its history and how this memory shapes its future in our future episodes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Angela.
You can find us on iTunes and through our website, which is audiostage.gorillasemiotics.com.